this is Robert Stark. My guest for today is Manuel Oceanrider in Germany.
Yes, hello, good evening. Hello, Mr. Stark.
And your publication, it's called Zuersta. Is that a print publication or is it only online?
No, the Zuerst magazine, it's a German print magazine, news magazine, which was founded 3 years ago. And we are a monthly news magazine, yes.
So the overall focus of Zuersta, it's not a philosophical publication, it's more of a focus on news.
Absolutely, it focuses on all type of news, which play a role also in the mainstream media. What means we cover news in internal politics in Germany, also, of course, foreign politics, world politics, but also cultural events and so on. So we cover everything, also the big ones, the big mainstream media is covering also.
So what sort of the news items would you say that you tend to focus on that the mainstream media does not focus on?
Well, we generally focus on almost the same things like the mainstream media is focuses on, but we have our own point of view, and of course we try to be in those issues we handle, we try to be much better than the mainstream. What means that we try to give the better information, of course that we try to give the truth, the real picture of something where the mainstream media is not covering in a, let us say, in a really honest or in a very, very much one-sided way.
So does the publications identify with any sort of officially with a political movement or ideology?
No, not at all. We have, you mentioned the name already, it's Zuerst, and Zuerst, it means in English first. So this first has for us a type of double meaning. Politically, we say very clear, the first means for us the German interest, the national interest stands at first, but it has also a media meaning that we say in many, many issues, we are the ones who bring the truth about that certain issue as the first one, and that we are not afraid to write about this. So this has the sort of double meaning, but we are not connected to any group or any political party. We are neutral in those things. But of course, we are reporting about what is going on the political stage, and also not just on the German political stage or the European political stage or even the world political stage.
So what are some of the biggest issues in Germany right now? Would you say one of it is the debt crisis and the issue with Greece?
Right. Oh, that's a good question, because right now I think one of the biggest issues is right in Germany are the upcoming elections at the September, the 22nd of September. We have the national elections for the Bundestag, for our national parliament. And this is now what makes the media busy and what makes the journalists busy. Of course, this has automatically the result that other issues which might be more important are not anymore focused. So this is right now what is happening on the mainstream German media side. Yeah.
So what are the two main political parties or candidates that are running right now?
Yes, these are from the two main parties. We have, of course, our Chancellor Angela Merkel. She's very well known now worldwide. So she tries to defend her position as a chancellor. She's from the Christian Democrats, the liberal conservative party, and the counter candidate is Mr. Steinbrück. He's from the Social Democratic Party, who tries now to get into the position of the chancellor. Politically, it's very, very hard to see very big differences between those two. Even it is very hard now to see already a lot of differences between the big parties, the two big parties, the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats. Maybe it is a little bit similar to the US when you compare the positions of the Republicans and the Democrats.
So So one thing you were saying is in Germany and in Europe as in Europe overall, the meaning of like the term right wing or conservative, it was defined by the Cold War, and the right. If you supported America and the West in the Cold War, that's what defined you as a right winger.
Yes, it is. I think not everywhere in Europe right now. For example, I just came back. I was the last 2 days in Flanders in Belgium, where the Flemish nationalists had a meeting, and they say very clear where they stay and that they are nationalists. So there it has maybe another more positive connotation to be right-wing or to be nationalist. In Germany, I think we find a special case. If you compare Germany to the other European countries, you will find out very quick that we don't have in Germany a moderate or any else right-wing party with 15 to 20% in the parliament, as you find, for example, in Austria, in France, in as I said, in Belgium, of course, but also in other countries, in Italy, in Poland, and so on. So we find in Germany, especially in Germany, a special situation, which has, of course, also to do with the fact that after World War II, everything what was connected or what was clearly connected to the nationalist cause or to a right-wing cause was somehow poisoned by the National Socialism, which governed before in Germany. So we find there a special situation. But what is also playing a big role also for today is that what you mentioned, this Cold War experience, what means that the conservative movements or conservative party in West Germany by that time, the number one issue of them was to be anti-communist and to be anti-Soviet. So what means that this was the main point they concentrated on. And until today, by the way, you find when it comes to the discussion about how to deal with Russia, when the Christian Democratic Party, which was in those times very much anti-communist and of course anti-Soviet, so they criticize now Vladimir Putin as a dictator and Russia as a type of dictatorship, of course with another perspective, with a postmodernist perspective, but the old role model seems still to be alive. And you find this also at here and there at old right-wingers, that they are very skeptic towards Russia and towards the East generally, while they have somehow, by their emotion, by their feeling, maybe it's somehow in their blood already, a more positive feeling towards the West, towards the US, when a lot of people tell you until today, yes, they protected our freedom, they defended us. They don't say the Americans were, of course, in Germany as occupation forces after the war and simply didn't left. No, they were friends, they were allies, they were protectors. So this is what you find until today, especially in Germany. I think this makes Germany very different to other European countries.
Because, I mean, there were nationalist movements in Europe that were very outspoken against American imperialism.
Sorry, I didn't understand the question.
I'm sure there were many nationalist movements in Europe that were very much opposed to American imperialism.
Yes, of course, and it's not just a nationalist issue. You know, we have also a lot of radical left-wing who were not outspoken nationalists, but who were arguing against the Americans. And it's somehow an irony when you look back in the Cold War times, especially in West Germany, when it came to Americanization and to Westernization of Germany, that by that time more the left-wing movements, maybe not voluntarily, but they did it, of course, because they were anti-American, but they argued in a nationalist way if they wanted or if they didn't want that. But the result was this. So there was a big criticism towards the West and towards America. Of course, by that time also, this should be also mentioned, the East, the Eastern Secret Services, the KGB and the Stasi in East Germany, were funding also those movements, because for them it was a very practical ally to bring a little bit disorder into the Western societies and to disturb them. But, of course, you find also in other countries very not just anti-American but Western criticizing movements and nationalist movements, of course, yeah. But in Germany it is still very difficult. We have those movements and parties here too, but right now it doesn't look like that one of them really becomes very successful. We have more movement in Germany maybe on the media sector, not in the sector of political parties and groups.
Can you give some examples of American influences on Germany that you've noticed firsthand?
Yes, of course. And this is really an interesting example what I can give you, because this is what about we report since we exist. And even before we existed as a magazine, we said very, very clear that Germany is, number one, still an occupied country, that Germany is, number two, a country with no sovereignty, and of course that everything what happens in Germany is monitored by US American intelligence, that everything is under control. And we were always saying, well, you see, that the Americans do this, this is on the one side, but that we have here a political class which acts like a puppet government, which acts like collaborators of this. This is the real scandal. So this is what we were saying from the beginning. And many people were saying, ah, you are conspiracy theorists. It is not so wild as you say. So now came out, since we know what Edward Snowden brought in his suitcase when he left the US, that many, many things are much worse than even we ever expected about that monitoring and that spying. We know that US American intelligence is using its intelligence power against Germany. Germany, we have to imagine, is not just a country like others in Europe. It's the strongest economy of Europe. It's the most influential country of Europe. Some say Germany, the Federal Republic of Germany, is the backbone of the European economy and also of the European politics. So they make control on this country. And by controlling this country, you easily also control the European Union, the European continent. But as I said, what we were saying, the scandal is not that the US is trying to do so, that they are trying to influence politics. The scandal is that we have a political class, and you find that political class not just in one party, you find them in the meanwhile in almost all the established parties, you find them everywhere in the media sector, you find them on the cultural sector, of course you find them on the financing market and the bank houses, who are serving those interests, who are serving the interests of others and not our own interests. So this was a main issue we were reporting from the beginning, even when the beginning, when the banking scandal came, the banking crisis, when we were saying this is not a crisis of our economy. This is not a crisis of the result of the work of our people. This is a crisis brought to us by the games of the big bank houses. So today, those things we were writing by that time, a lot of people were saying, "Ah, you are over-exaggerating the problem. You are this is now tending to become a conspiracy theory." But later on, it always turns out that we were right, that this was exactly what happened, and even we were too soft with our analysis. And you find this also in a lot of fields of foreign politics. For example, when we are reporting about Syria and the things that are going on, I have always the impression that here our team of our magazine, or also our partners who are cooperating with us, know much more and are much more clever than all the people in the mainstream magazines. What cannot be true, I think very often they know the full scale of the truth, but they simply don't print it.
So with the debt crisis in Greece, I think what you would get from the mainstream media sources is that the money from Germany is subsidizing mostly the Greek people. But I mean, you've pointed out that most of the money has actually not gone to the Greek people, but it's ended up in the coffers of the bankers.
You mentioned a very, very, very interesting example of how you can turn around truth and how you can make propaganda. It's always it's a little bit an irony that the mainstream media claims that our magazine, that our team, which makes Zuerst, that we are evil nationalists and so on. But they are the one right now who are putting oil into a fire of real xenophobe opinions. So when it comes to the euro crisis in Greece, we have to say very clear: it's not the guilt of the Greek worker, it's not the guilt of the Greek farmer, worker, employee. That this is the guilt of a very corrupt political elite in Greece, which was acting as they did. But they didn't do that alone. They had a lot of collaborators, and they had those collaborators, of course, in the banking system. But what our mainstream media does right now is they are giving news like, look, the Greek, they are lazy, they are not working enough, they are... Yes, and they are not paying taxes, they are not paying for electricity, and so on and so on. So in Greece, the same thing takes place with mainstream media. They say, look, Germany wants to control us, Germany wants to dominate us. They come back, it's worse than in World War II. So it's a game. You bring two people in Europe who had a very friendly relationship before, you bring them against each other, and they will stop discussing about the problems of the international banking sector. They start to complain about each other. So the Germans start complaining about the lazy Greek, and the Greek people start complaining about the control freaks from Germany who want to dominate everything, who want to buy everything. And I think this is also a sort of strategy to bring the people away from the real problems. Because, of course, not just, I'm convinced, not just 1 euro of that money which comes from Germany to Greece is really going to Greece. It's going to Wall Street. It's going to the bank houses where the Greek government took the debts in the past. And it is about paying this back. But you will not find as much criticizing of the bank houses as you find the criticism in the mainstream media of the people. So this is where we see in a very clear way how primitive this propaganda works, and this propaganda works all the time, non-stop with those things. It's also interesting that the same newspapers who do this propaganda say on the other side, we need the euro as we need the oxygen in the air. They say the euro is a question of war and peace. We need this euro so much because it brings peace to Europe. But what we can witness is that since the introduction of the euro, I don't know if ever before, since the end of World War II, European people were demonstrating in such a violent way against each other and started hating each other in that way. So I don't see any peace which was brought by that currency. And we don't have to forget that before the introduction of the euro, there was already a Europe since World War II, and there was peace in Europe, also without that currency. So just to say with this example, you see the full scale of how to turn around lies, how to use those lies, and how to use small parts of truth to play on the interest of the people and to make people upset and to make people, of course, forget about the real problem in the system and in the structure.
So one of the big items in the news right now is that the United States might actually go to war with Syria. And that's probably what you're probably most known for is your journalism in Syria. So what originally gave you the opportunity to go there?
Yes, we cover especially the Syrian conflict in a very intense way since the beginning. And it's somehow more or less, I have to admit, a coincidence that we have the opportunity to cover it in first-hand news, that we are not bound to copy paste from others, like all the mainstream is it now doing in Germany. It came that I was reporting in the past already a lot from Lebanon, that we made interviews with officials of Hezbollah, that we made interviews with officials of Hamas, that we always tried to get our foot in that field where the mainstream media is very, very weak, because it's one of my experiences when you talk to those people there and they have certain personal experience with a mainstream magazine from Europe, but also I mean from Germany, that they are very disappointed that the words they were saying were turned around in a bad way, that the facts they were delivering were ignored, and so on. So this was a good chance for us to step into that, let me call it, that angle of truth, and to put light on it, to put our light on it. So this is how I got the opportunity to go to Syria, where we are now, I think we can say, regularly to report from there. But we have also a lot of Syrian colleagues, Syrian journalists, who I met in person there and who are providing their news, their pictures, also interviews for us, and we translate it into German language and provide it for the audience. And it is a good thing that we notice that the people are very much interested in that issue. For us, it is important because many people think that why should we be interested in the Syrian conflict? It's so far away, and what do we have to do with it? But it's a matter of fact that the German government and the European system, Brussels, is putting a lot of oil into the fire in Syria. And I think that also my country, the Federal Republic of Germany, in their official politics, is causing a lot of problems and a lot of harm in that region. And this is what we tell the people. We tell them we support also with our taxpayers' money this cruel war, which has turned out not just against the Syrian army and the Syrian security forces, but also against the Syrian civilians. And I think this is what makes the people very interested in that issue. And of course, the fact that we are the ones who can provide news really from the ground, that we can speak to the people. What other magazines, especially the mainstream magazines, don't do. They copy-paste from US American magazines, from so-called independent NGOs, which turn out to be NGOs on the rebel side. So we can really provide objective and neutral news from there. Although, of course, the ones who are supporting the rebel side, which is almost the full mainstream sector, claim that we are close to the Syrian government. What is not true? We are very objective and very, very neutral.
So the way the media portrays the conflict in Syria is that they try to portray the rebels as being of the Syrian people, when that is totally false. The rebels are mostly, they're from outside of Syria. They're from Muslim communities in Europe. They're from the Gulf states. They're from Pakistan. But very few of them are actually Syrian.
Well, we face a lot of lies about that conflict. And one of the most important lies, and you were mentioning it already, is the lie about the popular uprising and the revolution by the Syrian people against their government. This is not true at all. Everybody who knows about Syria and who was there, and I think even US American media and politics had to recognize that a huge majority of the Syrian people right now support the Syrian government. I think right now much more support the government than they did before the crisis. When it comes to the question of the rebels, we have to see that Western media and politics always try to distinguish between two types of rebels. So we find there the bad rebels, the evil rebels, which are the Islamist terrorists, the extremists who are coming from foreign countries to do their jihad in Syria. So these are in the media presence, they are the bad ones. And then we have also the good rebels. These are the so-called moderate rebels of the Free Syrian Army, the FSA, where they say, look, these are the representatives of the Syrian people. But when we look on the ground, we see that the domination on the battleground among those rebel groups have, of course, those extremists. And as you mentioned, those extremists come from everywhere. We know right now, this is an information which is right now a couple of weeks old, that more than 1,000 European passport holders are right now fighting in Syria, maybe 100 of them coming out of Germany. We don't know exactly if these are ethnic Europeans or migrants. What we know from examples is that there are a lot of migrants among them. But I heard also the news from the northern Syrian city of Harem, which is at the Turkish border, where an eyewitness told me that he witnessed six German jihadis. And the interesting point was they had an interpreter.
Were they Germans or immigrants?
Yes, yes, they had a translator with them. They were ethnic Germans. These were six German jihadis, the witness told me, who had a translator with them because they didn't know how to speak Arabic, so they needed that translator. And this was a very interesting information for me because it shows it's not just concerning the migrant community. It also shows a radicalization or maybe an attract for some Germans attractive part of the Islamist ideology, which is now exported again to Syria. And what these people are doing there is they are killing people, they are killing civilians, they are placing bombs. So this is one interesting point. But the other interesting point is when we were talking about the moderate rebels and the extremist rebels is that this division is a complete artificial fantasy division. Because I give you two examples. The FSA has a brigade and it operated close to Damascus. And the FSA brigade was named by Osama bin Laden, the former leader of Al-Qaeda. And we all remember, for example, the rebel commander who was eating the heart of a killed Syrian soldier, the very well-known cannibal. And this person was not an extremist. This person was a so-called moderate rebel. And we have to put it now to our mind when we hear the U.S. State Department or also the German Foreign Ministry or the French Foreign Ministry, when we hear them talking about that we should support the moderate rebels, then we talk about those people who are doing as cannibals, eating the hearts and the livers. And this rebel commander even announced he will do this more often. So we know also that there is a close contact between those so-called moderates and so-called extremists. We know that the moderates sell weapons they get from the West to the extremists because the extremists have a lot of money they get from the Gulf monarchies. So there is no real division, and the dominating power on the battleground are the radicals. Syrians, I was talking about this, who were in touch, if these were people from the military, but also civilians were telling me that the FSA rebels, they were calling the thieves because they were looting a lot. They, for them, it was more or less for personal reasons, to loot shops, to loot banks, and so on. And the so-called extremists, these were the jihadis, the Islamist fighters. So this was the division they were doing. But they were not saying, these are the ones who fight for democracy and those are the ones who, the evil ones who wants to make a caliphate. And another interesting point is that I had the opportunity to go to many areas where FSA groups had control, at least for some days, and the army took it back. Last year it was... I was with one with an army group in the neighborhood of Al Midan in Damascus while they were cleaning it from rebel forces, and it was very fresh. It was a very fresh battleground. There was still shooting when I was allowed to go in there with the army, and we were seeing a lot of graffitis everywhere at the houses, and those graffitis were done by the FSA soldiers, but not just one graffiti, by the way. I always ask this, how many graffitis do you think we're handling about democracy, freedom, or human rights? Not a single one. These were all, you got to know who is a dog, that Bashar al-Assad is a dog, his wife is a dog, the Alawis are dogs, Bashar's sister is a dog, the Christians are dogs. So you saw all those insults, but you didn't see any claim for democracy and freedom. And I think this is one of the master lies of Western media, that they give the impression that among those fighters you have those good ones, the nice ones, and the really bad ones, and that the solution is, and this is what the Americans or the American politics are telling, so we should just support more the good ones so they can dominate the field and not anymore the bad ones. But what comes out at the end is that you deliver Stinger rockets to the FSA. The FSA delivers it to the Al-Nusra Front or to any other Islamist group. And maybe one day one of those Stinger rockets will shoot down a U.S. American civilian airplane somewhere else in the world. We don't know it. So I think this is a conflict like a boomerang. It will everything what the West does there right now will come back one day for bad, like a boomerang.
What do you see as the primary motivation behind the foreign backers of the rebels? I guess you can talk about the Saudi influence and the Gulf states that are backing the rebels, but also the motivation of the West for supporting them.
When it comes to Syria, we see a sort of spider web of geopolitical interests on this country. We see a lot of countries who have, let us say, like an old bill open with Syria. We know that for the Gulf states, it is always saying for them, it's not nice when there is an Arabic country which is so close with Iran as an ally of Iran. We know that Syria is also a big supporter of Hezbollah, and Saudi Arabia is not a big friend again of Hezbollah because they are Shia and they get their support again from Iran, which is the Shia center in that region. And that there is another Arabic state with Syria, which is the closest ally of Iran, is for Riyadh always a point of anger, and they always were trying to dominate because they wanted to dominate the region and they didn't want Iran to dominate the region. So for them, it is a good opportunity to dismantle Syria, to make Syria weak, to take the power of Syria. And also for other countries, when we see that for the US, it's not comfortable at all that Syria is an old ally of the Soviet Union, now of Russia, and that in Tartus is the naval base of the Russian Navy. So for Turkey, Syria is a neighbor for which Turkey would like to dominate, and they already said it, that they have a sort of neo-Ottoman dream. They want to become again the leading and dominating power in the region. So we see that Syria is somehow surrounded by those powers who have their own geopolitical interest, which is always somehow attacking the interest of Syria. And when it comes to what do they want with Syria, this is the question. So is it about that they want to change the government? Is it about, like the West tells us, that a new political system should be established which is somehow close to the West? Or is it maybe about something else? And I think this comes much closer to the truth. All those militant activities in Syria, the division of the Syrian people into the sectarian units, what was not before this in Syria, nobody was talking about his sectarian background. It was almost like in Germany, where I didn't know who is Catholic or who is Protestant. Now the people started, of course, talking about again, because there was this very harsh sectarian input, by the way, brought by the allies of the West and, of course, by Saudi Arabia.
What is the role of the Christian communities in the conflict in Syria?
This is a very interesting question because especially the Christian community is very much criticized and also persecuted right now by the Sunni radical militia which are fighting in Syria. The Christian community in Syria has the reputation of being very rich, of being very successful in business, and they have also the reputation, and you can read it even in Western mainstream newspapers, that they are profiteers, that they are regime profiteers, because they claim that they are so close to the Syrian government. So this brings a lot of sectarian hate right now against them. Of course, the Christian community in Syria, they define themselves, by the way, at the first part as Syrians, and then they are Christians. I think this is also a very important information. But of course, they enjoy to live in a secular country in the Middle East where they are not judged by their religion, but by the things they can or they can't. And it is a rumor that they are all rich. This reputation is a rumor. I also saw poor Christians or middle-class Christians. You find them as well as in other religious groups. So, but what happens now to them is that they face a lot of hate, which is brought in by those sectarian militias. So right from the beginning, when the so-called uprising started with a couple of demonstrations after the Friday prayers of radical preachers in mosques, was heard the claim, Christians to Beirut and Alawis to the tomb or to the grave, what means that they want to clean Syria. They want to have a pure, clean Sunni state, not anymore a national state, but a sort of religious caliphate, which we see now they try to establish in North Syria and the city of Raqqa and so on. So those Christians are right now under a lot of pressure. Christian quarters were fully destroyed, by the way, for example, in the city of Homs. Churches were looted by those forces. We see even pictures and videos of radical fighters who make fun about Christian symbolics and who hang them around, crosses around their neck and loot them and loot the gold and the old pictures in those churches. On the other side, the Christian community itself is very much disappointed by the West, because we don't have to forget that, for example, in Germany, a party is governing this country which calls itself Christian. It's the Christian Democratic Union of Angela Merkel, it's her party. And when they see that those parties who call themselves Christians are generally very much pro-American and that they also support the so-called armed opposition in Syria, what means the militias fighting against the Syrian army and also against the Syrian civilians.
The other thing to point out is that the American neoconservatives, their whole basis for their movement was 9/11 and Al-Qaeda, but they're actually supporting basically members of Al-Qaeda or supporters of it.
Yes, this is a very interesting point and a very weird marriage, let us say it like this. And you find this also in the Christian Democratic Union in Germany, by the way, when you see also when it not directly hits Syria or the Middle East, when you see that politicians of the Christian Democratic Union campaign a lot for Muslim migration to Europe or especially to Germany, when they say, yes, this is so important for us, and they are celebrating together with the Muslim community. And of course, they don't choose the moderate Muslim community. I met a lot of very, very good Sunni moderate people in Syria. So this is an important thing to say, because the Sunni community in Syria is the community which suffers most under this conflict, because they have the majority. The most people die in this conflict are Sunnis, but not because they are killed by Christians or Alawis or Shia or Hezbollah or by whoever, because they are considered as traitors by the radicals, because they are moderate, but they are not with the armed opposition. So this we should never forget before we get ourselves into the sectarian thinking of this conflict. What even Western pro-Assad supporters tend to do when they see somehow this cultural clash there.
So what is the relationship between Hezbollah and the Christian community? It's important to point out, because in the West, Hezbollah is viewed as a radical Islamic group. That's the equivalent of Al-Qaeda.
Exactly. And also in Germany and in other Western mainstream magazines, you found always the claim that Hezbollah is acting, especially in South Lebanon, where they have somehow the power, where they act as a sectarian radical force also against Christians, that they try to clean up their country from any other religious group than from the Shia. But all these things are simply not true. If any Western mainstream journalist would dare to step his foot himself into this sort of Hezbollah country, he would be very surprised, because he would find a lot of Christian villages there. And when he talks to those Christians there, they talk in the most friendly and positive way about Hezbollah. They are not persecuted at all. They are in a friendly relationship with the Shia community there. And you don't find there that clash or that conflict. And when you look on national politics in Lebanon, you see that Hezbollah is an ally of the Free Patriotic Movement, which is a Christian party of General Michel Aoun. So even there it functions. So the same is when you go to Syria right now, and when you go to Christian monasteries or Christian important religious pilgrim spots like Malula, for example, or also to Sednaya, where very old monasteries are. You find there everywhere pictures also beside, you find pictures, of course, of Mother Mary. You find pictures of Christian saints. You find also pictures, of course, of the president of Bashar al-Assad. But you also find pictures, a lot of pictures, of the general secretary of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah. So this is what you see. So you don't find there any sectarian conflict.
And I guess the other thing to point out about the Syrian conflict is the latest propaganda is that the regime has been using chemical weapons on civilians.
Yes, this claim is, by the way, not very new. We faced it a couple of times in the past. So this is the important red line U.S. President Barack Obama was mentioning last year. And I think it's not a coincidence that since he mentioned this, we heard about alleged chemical attacks turned out by the Syrian army against civilians, because this is the red line. And maybe it's an irony that we can say that it happened since Barack Obama mentioned this, because this gives those players in that conflict who want a Western intervention, a military intervention on Syria, a lot of energy and motivation, at least to provoke or to turn out themselves such a chemical attack. What is happening right now while we are speaking here, I think it's a very, very dirty game we witness here, because all the Western journalists and the Western politicians, they leave completely the path of logical thinking, because we have to watch very clear what is happening on the Syrian battleground. We see the Syrian army is doing a lot of efforts within the last month. They won very important decisive battles in important strategic regions. Let me just mention Al-Qasir, or let me mention the Battle of Homs, which is now almost finished. And they did this without any use of weapon of mass destruction or chemical warfare. Why did they do it? Because they didn't need it. It's not suitable for that battleground. You can ask any military expert. He will tell you you don't need any chemical gases or whatever. You need a good force which is trained to fight in a guerrilla warfare against another guerrilla group. But so we see there is no military benefit at all for the government side to use that. As well, there wouldn't be any military benefit for the rebel side to use it.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.